Welcome to RFN, episode 352. I am your host again this week, James Jones, which of course means that Johnny is still not with us. We look forward to Johnny coming back to the show, and we'll appreciate when he can return. With me this week, as most of the time, we make that joke every week till Johnny gets back, is John Lindemann.
A.K.A. the full meal deal.
No one's ever called you that.
How do you know, James?
Because no one should have ever called you that.
I've been around, James.
Also this week, and now permanently scarred by that thought, is Guillaume Veillette.
Hi.
And filling in for Johnny this week is our old dear friend, Mr. Greg Lee.
You sick of me yet? You will be. You will be.
Well, we did it for 4 years, so I think we'll be okay.
This is it. This is the critical point. That's why I got out when I did. I knew I was getting close.
Oh.
That's Godfather 3 right here.
Oh.
I play the role of Sofia Coppola.
We're definitely going to end the show. Stay tuned next week to when we don't do an episode, because Guillaume's just ruined it for everyone. All right, but I guess we have to continue on anyway, because this is what we do. So, as usual, we start with Now Playing. Of course, following up after that, we're going to have our conclusion of our retroactive of Pandora's Tower. But, as guests do, Greg, would you like to start us off?
Sure, yeah. So, I've played way too many things since the last time I did a new business to recount them all here. But it kind of most recently, I finished up everything on Rayman Legends. I certainly enjoyed it enough to play it through to exhaustion. Probably not as much as the most positive reviews, you know, that like, oh, it's the best platformer of the kind of platformer renaissance. Or so. I'm not there with it, but you know, the presentation's great, and you know, I certainly enjoy a lot of the new levels. Definitely, I think the new levels put the old ones that they included in it, which I'd not played before from Origins. The new levels definitely put those, I think, in a somewhat unfavourable light. I think that I like the new ones a lot better, but yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. And then, but what I've been playing more recently is the updated release of Tokitori 2. Yes. Tokitori 2 Plus, as it's referred to now. So, yeah, they kind of relaunched the game a little bit. I guess they'd already done it on PC, this version, but it was always going to be coming out on Wii U. This updated sort of patch version, it's got somewhat better graphics, apparently, some extra details visually. And then they've cleaned up a few things design-wise and that kind of stuff. And then for the first week, it was discounted quite significantly. Mm-hmm. I think originally it would have been, over here, it would have been about £13 full price, and then it was down to under £8. So, you know, pretty significant, I think, it's, you know, a similar kind of deal elsewhere. And, you know, so that really got me off the fence to get it, because it has, you know, it always seemed like something that I'd enjoy from when it came out back in, I think it was April, the original release. And, of course, Guillaume mm-hmm. reviewed it for Nintendo World Report, you know, amongst a number of positive reviews I read that made it seem like I'd enjoy it, but didn't get around to it right away. And then there was the whole thing out there that, like, oh, you know, they're working on this kind of improved version of it. So I thought, well, hang on.
Fuck you, early adopters.
Yeah, well, it's
well, I'm perfectly happy to have played the version that's not for babies.
I don't think it's
the version for real men who love real puzzles.
See, one day Guillaume's going to learn to troll, and we're all going to be shocked.
It's over. You're probably overselling how radical the changes are there, but of course I can't know for sure because I never played the pre-plus version. But yeah, so I definitely, the lower price and all that kind of thing definitely made it seem like this, that was the main thing, to be honest. If they just discounted it, I probably would have bought it this time anyway. But that just the addition of it being the superior version helped. And so, yeah, I've played it. It's a weird kind of game to describe as that you've beaten it, but there is kind of a main goal to the game. Where you can see the credits, although because it has no kind of exterior like presentation or anything. Even the credits are in like a little screen that's built into the environment. You know, like it takes itself very kind of seriously in that way. It maintains this consistency of like everything's kind of just in the game world. Anything of the menus or any of that kind of doesn't really tell you anything. You know, it's so kind of streamlined and very elegant in that you can do two things and that is it. And that's all you will need to do. The stomping and the whistling as the bird character, that's it. And I mean, that's really one of the most interesting things for me about how it was, having read the reviews carefully when it came out. You know, I knew what to expect, but it was interesting to me seeing, for instance, like in the official blurb for Steam, you know, the Steam version, it refers to it as a Metroidvania style game. And I mean, there's senses in which that would seem accurate, but there's a lot of important ways for me in which it isn't. I mean, I don't want to get into a sort of semantics on what Metroidvania means, because it's used pretty loosely.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered what's wrong with just calling something a Metroid style game. Like, you know, I mean, why do we have to have the Vania sort of...
There's no RPG elements in this game, so...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it had explicit, like, leveling and equipment and all that kind of stuff, like, those RPG trappings that Castlevania brought to the genre, I could kind of get it more. But in this case, the area where I would say it's a bit of a misnomer, mm-hmm, is the fact that you do only have two core abilities, and they never change. You don't really get anything, you know, that's like, oh, well, now I can do this, and so I'll go back to another area and, you know, do some, you know, screw attack that gets me over a barrier or something. Like, that never happens. I mean, that's the purity of this game. It's really one of its great strengths, mm-hmm, of the design, is that you only ever have these two actions, and yet as you explore around this world, which is, you know, sort of, you know, continuous and all that, and that's why it is somewhat like a Metroid game, you will encounter things, you're like, well, how do I do this? But you know for certain that there isn't some, you know, MacGuffin somewhere that you have to collect to do. You have all the tools you need. You just need to reason it out. And that's what I like about it, is that, you know, that certainty that it gives you, that just, you know, you don't have to sort of go back and forth in your head, like, oh, shall I go somewhere else and do this? You know, you're just like, no, I can do this. Mm-hmm. I just have to think about it a bit more.
There are sections that basically teach you certain abilities if you haven't figured them out yet. Like, you might come across a lot of puddles in the game, but only when some bird picks you up after you've been in the puddle and makes you fly over a certain section of ground, and you see that you're still dripping wet, and the water that falls down makes grass grow, and that's important to avoid certain enemies.
No, that's like, exactly right. I mean, I think the key is that, yeah, certain level design will make some of these tricks that you can pull off with the, you know, the core abilities that you have readily, mm-hmm, apparent to you.
Yeah.
So what will happen, therefore, is that it isn't, you know, truly like a Metroid-style game where you actually get a new ability and apply it to different places and do things you absolutely could not do before. But by teaching you, you may come back to something that you did before and then say, oh, well, actually, this is a lot more oblique than it was before. But actually, you know, I know where this is going now. You know, I could, you know, like you said, the trick with the grass or various other things with different animals and all that kind of stuff that you said, the level design is very clever that way, in that it will kind of, somewhere there'll be something that will introduce you to an idea, a trick that you can do, and then you'll get sort of a whole bunch of different scenarios where that'll come into play in a less obvious way, or it might combine with another idea. And that's the thing. I mean, I played through, I haven't got everything in the game. I'm kind of to a point where I've gone and started picking up some of the additional things, like the golden wing fragments, mm-hmm, some extra ones, because there's kind of a secret area that's hidden behind like four locks that you unlock by sort of filling up these little fonts with the gold wings. So I'm kind of interested to see what's behind there and just enjoying kind of going back through it. But, you know, just the amount of, it is weird how it almost simulates a Metroidvania type experience in that way, that you do suddenly look at things differently and start pushing further and finding more things. And it's just what I really liked about it was the fact that, yeah, you know, you have this game that doesn't explicitly teach you anything, but it does show you things if you're paying attention, if you're observant. And that's all you need. You know, I mean, I was able to kind of complete the game, yeah, to the extent that, you know, I have completed it, without like consulting any FAQs or like looking on Miiverse, which, you know, is an option that's there. That's nice that for people that do want to do that. But just, you know, just as long as you've got the kind of discipline to think about it. And also don't overcomplicate it. Like, cause you, some of the stuff where it gets more convoluted, like you could start imagining like really complicated solutions to maybe like and start like, and then as they get more convoluted, it gets harder to actually just set them up to try them out. Mm-hmm. So you can waste a certain amount of time in that way, but a lot of that, some of that, you will be you overcomplicating it rather than, come on, you know, do they really want you to do this? You know, think about it. You know,
yeah. Like, in my review, I included a doodle of some puzzle that I tried to get past, and we were just mathematically trying to figure out the number of squares that you could walk before lava would catch up with you. It was completely the wrong track, you know? It's, you have to approach it with kind of a laden mindset where if you have to take out a calculator, you're on the wrong track and you're doing it wrong.
Just think about the fact that, you know, the game developers, you know, they made this, they're testing it, so they wouldn't want you to do that, would they? So,
yeah.
Chances are it's not required, and so yeah, that's what I really like, that kind of that I think Johnny sort of mentioned this kind of idea before. It's almost sort of this tacit kind of communication or interaction that you have with the game developers. You're kind of imagining, you know, what they were thinking when they were putting this together as a way for you to kind of solve these puzzles and do what they were expecting you to do. And so just that kind of, there's a real genuine sense of discovery with the game though, because it really doesn't explicitly tell you anything that, you know, even though, like I said, the fact is, they're kind of prodding you in a bunch of ways. There is just, when you do achieve that connection with their intent and deliver on it, there's a feeling there that you don't get from a lot of games these days, you know, because there is so much fear of people being lost and becoming disinterested in something and frustrated with it because they don't feel it's adequately explained. And obviously, the one thing I say is, well, it's all well and good to harken back to the good old days of games that didn't do that. But then you'd have stuff like, you know, Simon's Quest or, you know, that where, yeah, it's just like, yeah, it doesn't tell you what to do. Or in some cases, it tells you the wrong thing to do because the localization is bad or whatever. But equally, you know, like they were not those sorts of games. While, yeah, it was fun, you know, at the time, and you could have the patience to play it when you're a kid or whatever, they were not designed as carefully as Tokitori 2.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is designed so carefully and intelligently to guide you, you know, without explicitly guiding you.
Yeah,
you know,
it's impressive as heck.
It's very, very careful, very considered. Nothing's there by accident. You know, just think about it like that. You know, every little detail in there, you know, so this is probably going to serve some kind of purpose. And the interesting thing that I found now, going back and collecting some of these wings, is that there's puzzles within puzzles that, you know, just clearing like one key puzzle to get past an environmental hazard or something is one part of it, but there might be a sort of a group of these golden wings somewhere that actually sort of brings like a layer of an additional layer into that puzzle that's actually quite a lot harder, might require quite a lot more reasoning out. It's only, I guess, it's there for complete. It's almost like a sort of very organically woven in hard mode, if you like, you know, like they're just built into the puzzles that already exist. I don't know whether that's anything that's been brought in with the plus version, whether they've added anything in that regard, or whether I assume it's just that's the way the design is in general. But that was impressive to me, that, you know, if you're of a mind of like, okay, I've kind of done the core challenge of the game there, but I enjoyed it, so I'm just going to go around and see what I can do picking up these extra things. Mm-hmm. There's actually, it's not just a kind of drudgery of marching from one place to the other. You know, you actually do get new kind of puzzle content, and there's some secret areas that are not really essential to the core game that you can find and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, I'm very enamored with it. It's definitely delivered on my expectations. And I think some of the improvements they've made, like adding these like mole hills that can skip like particularly kind of crunchy bits of puzzling that would make retraversal kind of difficult. It helps with this sort of post-game phase that I'm in now, where I'm just trying to find some of these extra gold wings and stuff. So yeah, I mean, if this sounds like the kind of game that would appeal to you, but you know, you haven't got in on it yet, sadly the price cut thing will be over by the time this goes out. But I would assume it would be well worth the full price for me, because it's a really rare sort of treat of game design that I've enjoyed.
Yeah, and it's interesting how a lot of the feedback that they got from the Miiverse is what inspired them to go and tweak some things, right? Like, they had this direct window on what people were getting stuck on, and they could just, okay, well, let's fix this a little bit so that there's less of a sticking point here.
So major publishers have long since reported they get metrics back on games, and they can look at where people spend, like what step people spend time on, how far they get into a game when they quit. And there's always been this sort of kind of we're listening, but you may not know you're talking to us. But they never, or very rarely that I could think of. I can't think of a specific example at the moment, although I know there's been at least one. They sort of react to these things in a kind of for our future game design purposes. Let's make something more clear than this. This didn't work. I don't know. I can't think of a specific instance where they've said, "Well, this isn't working." And people playing the game right now, let's try to tune this.
Right. I get the feeling that because on consoles, it used to be, I don't know about every console, but I know that Microsoft asked for, like, the first patch was free, and then you had to pay $40,000 for subsequent patches. So I think that this kind of fine-tuning as the game got into players' hands, I don't think really happened before. But now these updates are free for on Nintendo consoles and the other consoles. So I guess that they can more directly change these sticking points, you know, to refine the games as while people are playing it. But because there's so many series now that are annualized, I get the feeling that this feedback that they're getting is just being put toward like into the next game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would really depend on how much work would be involved with the stuff that they have to change. And also, I'm sure they could put in hooks. I mean, if they're putting in hooks to monitor stuff after the fact, then they've probably designed things in such a way that they can go in and change them easily, that they're easily patchable, right? Like, in other words, they don't have to do some huge overhaul to change elements like this.
Right.
Now, the kind of game it is, I think it would kind of, you know, open itself up to that. And of course, like, they were preparing to sort of launch it on, you know, PC and Steam and stuff, you know, so they had, they've been preparing like a level editor for it and stuff. So, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I guess, especially with how small the Wii U install base was in April, you know, it was almost like a little test group for them to kind of iterate on it and then get it back out there, to a wider audience some months later. But as I said, I can't really comment on how much it's improved matters or anything. It seemed like it was pretty good in the first place from the reviews I read. But where they've got to now, I'm very, very satisfied with it.
Right. And is the level editor in the Wii U version yet? Or
I don't think it is yet, no.
Okay. They've mentioned that they want to.
Yeah, they're still committed to that happening, I believe, but it's not in there yet. I can't imagine it'd be the kind of thing that I'd ever play with. I'm not really that way inclined.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know. It might be interesting to see if
I imagine people could come up with some clever stuff if it was like shit. Yeah, it could be shared. Yeah, I could imagine some devious kind of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm interested in this game now slightly more than I was since I last played it, which was at PAX. I don't know. There's always that kind of reservation for me about this sort of game, but if it's just straight up puzzle solving, I feel a little bit better about it. And knowing that they've had a time and actually taken the effort to iron out some of the puzzle kinks makes me feel a little bit better.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, the Metroid angle, I wouldn't get hung up on that whatsoever. If you sort of done like that, it is a puzzle game, and the reach reversal, especially with like warping and stuff, the reach reversal kind of component of it would only really come in if you're trying to find every last thing. If so you kind of take that or leave that, however you want. And the other thing is, I wouldn't have thought it'd be the kind of thing to demo that well, because it's so kind of slow and deliberate, and it is something that you kind of I kind of like to just play, sitting down, kind of thinking about it, taking my time, sort of in a way, kind of in terms of your physical kind of interaction, it's very casual, but in terms of your mental engagement, it can be quite a matter of concentration. So yeah, I couldn't imagine doing that in a public setting and really getting a good feel for it. So
I just remember, I'm surprised you had a bad demo at PAX, because I thought it was great. Like I remember,
I didn't have a bad demo. I just wasn't excited coming out of it.
Okay. Because I was just, I was crossing the screen, I was just walking through the tall grass, and I hear next to me the developers chuckle, and I'm just like, what? And yeah, you just missed like one of the puzzles. And you bastard. Where?
There's one in the volcano. There's like a puzzle hidden in the volcano level that's kind of like those DKC silhouette levels.
Yeah.
You just walk past it and you don't know it's there. It's exactly like that. You have no idea it's there, and it's not something that's essential to like beating the core game at all. But the first time I went through, I was completely oblivious to it, and then the next time I just stumbled right into it, and I was like, oh wow, they really got me there. There's loads of that stuff. You play almost like mind games between you and the designers. I love it.
Yeah, it was weird to go from Octodad to this. Let's put it that way. and on the note of Octodad, because that's really the note you should always move on. Guillaume, what have you been playing this week?
I've been pretty busy, so I haven't had time to play any full games other than what I'm already playing right now, like Shin Megami Tensei, which I'm kind of stalling on. I'm near the end, but there are choices that affect the ending that you get. And I'm stupid like that. I want to get the best ending the first time around. But you have choices that you have to make, and they add or subtract points on a like kind of a chaos or order scale, and you want to be neutral as much as possible, and I'm just paralyzed at this point.
So why is that considered the best ending?
It's just the way Shin Megami Tensei.
It's the one where you get to nail all your monsters.
No. I guess, I don't know. Like,
it's hardly neutral, James.
I guess I'm not really, an expert in the subject, but Shin Megami Tensei, usually that's the way it goes. Like, the forces of the awful creatures are usually jerks, and the chaos are no better, right? I don't know. And I think it has also something to do with... I'm venturing into dangerous territory here. What religion are Japanese people usually...
They are a mix of Shinto Buddhistic ideas.
Right. Wouldn't that be kind of, part of their mentality a little bit?
Like neutral, like maintain balance and harmony kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah.
In Buddhist elements, it would be to an extent, yes.
All right. So, yeah, there's that. But anyway, I haven't been really playing that, not far away from an FAQ. So I've been instead plunging into the Etrian Odyssey Untold, the Millennium Girl demo, which is the remake of the first Etrian Odyssey game. It's made in the Etrian Odyssey 4 engine, so it's on 3DS, it's in 3D. So they're giving us this remake of the first game, and if you know the series at all, from one game to the next, the games are pretty much always similar. It's always the same kind of premise. You are mapping your progress physically on the bottom screen, on the touchscreen of the 3DS, and you're drawing your maps as you go, and you're adventurers, and you're trying to, reach the end of the dungeons. So why remake the first game? It's not as if, if you want more map making, you can always move on to the second game, and then the third game, and then the fourth game.
It's a little odd to the extent I followed it. So they've essentially given it a plot, right? Now, yeah. The first, they don't really have much story. And so what they've actually done is made a story mode for this remake where you've got like preset characters to begin with. And it had, so it is a remake, but it's also like this weird cut. It seems like it's really trying to be like a new entry point to the series. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, like, you know, so, okay, well, this is redoing the first one, and we're going to have some story elements that might entice people in that aren't just excited at the thought of map making in right. itself. But then, wouldn't it have been better if this had come before the fourth one? In that case, like, you know, because it just seems like if, you know, I mean, first of all, they come out bizarrely close together. And
like there's like 7 months.
So yeah, I if I find it a little bit curious, it just seems like, I mean, for people that have already played the fourth one and enjoyed it, it doesn't seem like this would be something, unless they're just, you know, happy to gorge on entry and obviously every given opportunity. It doesn't seem like it's really for them that much, apart from maybe the classic mode.
Yeah, personally, I'm not hungry for more Etrian Odyssey. If I were, I would just go do the final dungeon, like the bonus dungeon that I didn't do the first time around in Etrian Odyssey 4. But let me explain though, like yes, they've added some sort of story mode to the original game, but it's not as if Etrian Odyssey is story free. There is a story. There are right. characters that you meet and there's dialogue and stuff like that. But your party are just like blank vessels. Like they're just classes, and they don't talk really. They're just like adventurers, and they accept quests, and it's the NPCs that move the story forward, you know. So right. Yeah, I'm pretty sure like I was saving the world in Etrian Odyssey 4, or you know.
you were saving a blank vessel of a world,
right? But the so yeah, Etrian Odyssey 4 had basically just enough story for, you know, for its purpose. Like, you needed a motivation to delve into dungeons. You know, well, you got it, you know. And it's, yeah, there was a lot of dialogue, but it was not, it didn't really impress me with its dialogue. It was not super writing. So I was a little bit skeptical when they said, okay, we're remaking the first one. We're going to add more story. I'm not exactly the type of person who will just be, oh yes, more story. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Like, is it any good? And after playing the demo, if I were to get this game, I don't think I would go into the story mode. Because really, the characters all seem to be your cliche, stereotypical anime characters. You know, all the different tropes are there. And the dialogue is them talking to each other, wondering what the hell's going on. And telling each other, okay, we should go here, we should go there, we should go there. You know, it's not the most gripping of stories. And I don't know. Like, I feel like perhaps this was really a mode that they put in to draw in people who would be perhaps intimidated by the idea of having to create and customize a whole party and, you know, go adventuring like that.
To ease them into the idea, because yeah. It's not like this. You still have to kind of, you can still modify the characters after a certain point in the story mode, right?
Right.
It's just, you know, they do start off as something. They're not just blank slates.
Yeah, and they do, like, they come with preset classes, and I don't think, maybe you can change them later on, but I think only very far into the game. So you're really giving up the possibility of being able to customize your party to your liking for having a little bit more guidance, having a little bit more of a set path. And so I guess if you were really intimidated by Etrian Odyssey 4, perhaps this is the game for you. But I was new to Etrian Odyssey 4, and I'm not, you know, an RPG nut. Like, from back in the day, I never drew maps on graph paper. I never did any of that stuff, but it came to me pretty easily. It just, you know, you just have to think a little bit about what you're doing. Anyone can figure it out. In my opinion, I felt like the demo for Etrian Odyssey 4 was the kind of the entry point, the perfect entry point for someone new to the series. There you had a free taste of the series. You could see if it was good or not, and it was basically the beginning of the game, where you could create your party and you could test it out and you could play for as long as you wanted, up to, you know, level 10 for your characters. And, like, it was a good, like, 3 hours of gameplay. So I'm not really sold on Etrian Odyssey, I'm told. And not only you're giving up the ability to customize for having a set story, but you also only have... There is a mode in the game where you can play the game as originally intended. You can customize a party, create it for yourself and everything, but then you don't go through the story. And the game only has one save file. So you choose one of those two options, and you're stuck with it for the next 40 hours.
Wow, that sucks.
Yeah, that seems like an oversight, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I made the joke that maybe they just needed the money, but, I mean, that's not a terrible... It's not necessarily a joke.
Actually, Neil was telling me that through his contacts, through his sources, apparently Etrian Odyssey 4 sold more than the previous three games combined.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. I mean, it sold well, so maybe they wanted to rush another game out.
Oh, okay.
So they reused the engine, and they basically reused the setting of game one and said, all right, let's just jump real quick. Because they picked the game that would probably have the least number of previous players, the first one.
Right.
And then said, well, we can remake that. But it may also be they're planning to chart a slightly more traditionalist JRPG path.
Make it a bit more like mainstream in Japan, maybe. And then, you know, by extension, kind of perhaps in Western market. I mean, I'm impressed that it's got localized so recently after...
It was very quick.
After 4, you know, I mean, I am impressed with that.
Yeah, I wonder if they're just trying to chart this new path towards... Maybe when 5 rolls around, we'll see. It was considerably more story-oriented.
Or to at least have a mode, you know, that they get the same kind of dichotomy.
Right, and this was sort of a practice go at it.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't be terribly shocked if that's where they're... Or at the very least, they're trying it out before they commit to doing it and see how the fans take it.
Right. I remember saying earlier this year, I want to become an Atlus fan because they're the only third party making games for their 3DS sometimes, it feels like. So I was like, yes, I'm going to get all their games and I'm going to enjoy it, damn it.
That's a fool's errand.
It is. I don't...
As a longtime Atlus fan, that's a fool's errand.
It is. I don't understand their release schedule.
They don't understand release schedules, Guillaume. Don't try to think about it. I've been buying Atlus games for like 15 years. There's no logic to it.
Yeah, but these games are way too close to each other. I'm not done with Shin Megami Tensei 4, and here comes Etrian Odyssey, and just before Shin Megami Tensei, there was Devil Summoners, and I skipped that because I was still playing Etrian Odyssey 4.
Guillaume, they've released games on the same day before.
Yeah.
Logic doesn't work there. It's just chaos.
Well, and now that they've been bought, I think things are probably
by
gonna
Sega.
Get even...
Things aren't going to get any better. They're going to get worse.
So, yeah, you know, that's exactly it. You know, well, at least now they'll be managed a little bit better.
Really? What evidence do we have to indicate that's going to happen?
I think he was being sarcastic.
Sorry, James. I just like to make jokes sometimes.
They're gonna be managed by drunken apes.
Yep.
And they're all every Etrian Odyssey game from this point forward stars Sonic making out with human girls.
Well, that's the thing. We're gonna have crossovers now with, like, you know, Sonic and Shin
Megami
Tensei.
Oh God! Oh,
it's gonna happen.
Imagine if they actually sort of cancelled the Fire Emblem crossover with Shin Megami Tensei for Fire Emblem crossover with Sonic. Due to
made by BioWare.
Greg just made me throw up my mouth a little bit. Oh. It's going to be terrible. All right, so on that depression bombshell, we're going to roll this over to John.
Speaking of depression, yeah, I haven't really been playing anything new, but I have been banging my head against Ninja Gaiden still. I'm on level 6.63.
Hey, speaking of fool's errands.
Ninja Gaiden
this is fool's
Prime.
Errand. I mean, I got to say, level 6 is... It sucks so bad. I'm finally broken, and I'm going with the with save states.
No,
unabashedly. I don't even care,
John.
Say what you will about me, Guillaume. Judge me all you want. I don't care.
John and I beat Castlevania. I mean, John and I beat Super Ghouls and Ghosts during the retroactive. We're allowed.
I don't have to to judge you, John. I'm sure that deep down the shame is eating you away. You know, it's just
It's just I just don't have the time for this kind of stuff anymore. You know, I'm a busy man, Guillaume. I have stuff to do.
Also, but, I would say there's different levels of abusing save states. You know what I mean? Like if you're doing it after every successful screen, then
Yeah. I have no shame. All shame has gone out the window.
That is despicable.
I am a despicable man, then, Greg.
Some elements where this game is abusing you if you don't have save states. It's like, hold on, there's going to be a bird right as the screen pans. Oh, look, a bird.
It's ridiculous. I mean, really, it truly is just trial and error until you figure out the exact perfect way to do a certain part of each level. And literally, I mean, it's maddening. There are certain parts of it where... See, the thing is, too, I realized as I was about to throw my 3DS out of the window, I realized that the way it really screws you over is not necessarily the amount of enemies that it randomly throws onto the screen at certain points. And it does knock you back, but other games do that too. But what it does, the subtle way that it screws you over, is it turns you around. So you get hit. Not only do you get knocked back.
Yes.
It turns you around so you can't even kill, you know, because you do have a second there where you can't be hit. Mm-hmm. But you're facing the other way, so you can't even hit the enemy that you were just fighting.
Nope, but he can hit your ass again.
Exactly, and then as soon as you come out of your state there where you can get hit again, you just get knocked back. But then you get turned the other way, and then you get hit again, and turned the other way, and the other way, and so it's you just lead to these kind of ping pong things where you just get dunk 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 dead. So yeah, that happens about five or six times in a row, and you're just like, yeah, this is fucking ridiculous. Yeah. It's absolutely maddening.
What history hasn't recorded is that the Kamakura Shogunate's best weapon against ninja were crows.
Yeah. So I'm at 6-3 now, and it's just a slog because, I mean, literally, I got fed up, and I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to save state this entire game until I get to the end. So,
every button push is a save state.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I'll come up to a particularly difficult area. And I'll save state it there and then run it through and try to do it as well as I can. Like, I'm not literally save stating every single point or whatever, but I'll try to do as well as I can. And instead of going all the way back to the start of, 6-3 or wherever it puts you, I don't even care where it puts you anymore, but instead of being sent all the way back and having to do like two or three areas in a row that are incredibly annoying, I will just go right back to my save state instead. So,
yeah, I mean, there's an argument to be made that there's not, I mean, you've already paid for the game. Might as well get to see the damn thing to its conclusion.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, the problem I have with it is that really they just make it harder by making it cheap and basically taking control away from the player. So I'm not going to sit here and be victimized by that, when it's really not fun. I mean, a lot of the times in this game, in the last area, it's just not fun. It's just a real pain in the ass.
You can't hurt me anymore!
Yeah, well, that's the thing too, And I that's the thing with Ghouls and Ghosts. It's I never get as angry with that game because I feel like when I get, even though there are like kind of random attacks from enemies,
oh yeah,
it's you have a chance, you typically have a chance to kind of regroup, but right here you do not have that chance, so it's just it was probably a bad call when I was watching football and my team lost and I was really pissed off and I decided to blow off some steam by playing this game, and I was like, what the hell am I doing? And, so it just kind of fed my rage.
John was just drinking from the rage hall.
Yeah, it wasn't really the greatest idea. I wouldn't do it again. But the other new business that I have is, you guys will be happy to know that my Wii U is bought, paid for, in the mail right now. It should get here on Friday. So
you will get the. So you will have a Wii U finally.
We will finally have a Wii U, and
as a team will be complete.
Yes. And I will have Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate and New Super Mario Brothers U.
Oh, and Zelda.
And Zelda, of course, yep. Yep. Nice. And I'll also, the first thing I'll do is I'll grab Earthbound, too.
Are you going to save the hell out of that, too?
We'll see. I reserve the right. I reserve the right to do that.
I tell you what, when I've played games like RPGs, one thing, and like adventure games and stuff like that on Virtual Console, one thing that I do find nice to save state is just where you have like a trek to a boss. Like, it's not even that you're doing anything or like beating enemies that aren't just trivial grind fest, like low level enemies. But you just have to walk from one place to the other to get to the boss to fight him again. I always save state that because it's just pure fluff. It's just taking up your time.
There should be a save point right there.
Yeah, you may as well be. So I always, I always do stuff like that, and it makes them a lot more playable for me. And it's one of those reasons why, like, those kinds of games, I've got a much higher clearance rate of those on, like, 3DS and Wii U Virtual Console than I did on the Wii Virtual Console. Mm-hmm.
And, right. and sometimes, like, those last bosses have, well, just won't shut up. So that's also, yeah, that's also
a good point. It's a good point, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. That's the nice thing about going back and kind of playing through these old games is that you realize that, you know what? I don't really have to kind of I don't really care about getting enough time out of this game like I would back when I
I mean, you wanted it to last longer in the old days because you weren't going to get another game for however long or this, that, and the other. But yeah, now, I mean, it's kind of customizable, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, how much of that time you want to claw back.
Yep. So, so with Earthbound, I'm just going to save state the hell out of that game and just whatever.
Do it.
Hopefully I can find a cheat code that'll take me right to the end boss. Oh,
there we go.
Yeah.
It just plays the credits. The cheat code just plays the credits. Like, I beat the game. I did.
I did complete Earthbound relatively recently. The end boss is not very cheerful and kind of massively disturbing. I don't know. That would not be the point of the game I'd skip to.
Or maybe the exact point you'd skip to. All
right. We'll see.
No, we won't. Not you won't, John. Let's not kid ourselves.
With save states? Maybe I will.
We'll see. We'll hear even.
Oh, maybe. So, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up new business. Speaking of things that won't shut the hell up. So, I have reached the end, although I have not cleared it, of Valkyria Chronicles, which I spoke about last week. The immediate reaction I had to that game was that the game puts you in positions where it basically doesn't give you proper intelligence, and you're forced to sort of select your characters you're going to take into the battle without a real concept of whether or not they're going to be effective in this particular fight. And the example I cited was this big dumb tank that up until this point you have been using, you know, anti-mechanized forces on tanks, and the whole mission is kill this tank. But in fact, those units are completely useless in this battle. And instead, you want the lightest infantry units you have. So as I progressed through the game, it got a little bit less ridiculous on that front. But a lot of it was because I learned tactics for how to manage the unknown and, you know, not using up my entire allotment of units, trying to leapfrog and bring units in midway through the battle.
Oh, so you can do that.
Yeah, so I don't have to march them all the way up to the midfield. So, like, there's a strategy I've adopted in a lot of these hold and clear missions where I have essentially, I go in with really light infantry and maybe a sniper in support and try to get to the first capture point as quickly as I can, since the game is usually just capture the flag, and then summon in my heavier, slower, more ponderous units so they start already halfway into the battlefield, and then use them to sort of break through the second, usually more thick defensive layer. In general, that strategy was pretty successful for me. It was really effective in a lot of the mid-game missions. They sort of push you on these special missions you can actually unlock that provide backstory to characters, so you don't have to play them. You have to pay money to get them, sometimes exorbitant amounts of money.
Wait, what? Money in-game currency?
Yeah.
Okay, not DLC.
Not real money. Not real money, no. Because the whole premise is the game is a book. You're going through this book a journalist created chronicling this one unit throughout this war. So it's all written sort of looking back. And you buy these you basically fund her writing these extra chapters, and then you go play the mission attached to them. And a lot of times they're really weird missions. They're like, you only can take 3 units into this battle, and you have to destroy this one tank. Well, normally destroying one tank's a trivial affair, but the only way you can get to the tank, if you just try to approach it directly, you'll get eaten alive. So you have to sort of kind of wander through the back alleys of the street to try to get behind it. But there's enemies on patrol, and you have to hit them when they're not looking. It's a lot of stuff. Or there's a mission where you have to rescue hostages, which means you can't be seen, and you have to kill all the enemies in one turn. So there's lots of these little, like, quick, these smaller missions that really push your ability to understand the game's mechanics and how to use them best to your advantage. And those have been a lot of fun. But what I found is late in the game, some of these missions just feel patently unfair. You know, you can take 5 units in, and all you have to do is hold the flag for 8 turns, but the enemy has 40 units, including 3 heavy tanks. Have fun. And you're just like, I can't do it. I can't freaking do it. There's not enough turns to control the battlefield and control all these patrol points. And it's a lot of just pushing your understanding of the game's mechanics really to their absolute limit.
And then a bird flies by and knocks you into a chasm.
Pretty much. So it'll be like you've stopped in advance on one point. You're getting ready to hit them from the side, and then you just stumble across a landmine hidden in the grass, and the vanguard unit you had is down. So you have to suddenly shift all your resources to rescuing them before they're permanently killed. It's just like the whole mission just goes completely to shit in one turn. So the game actually lets you save in-game so you can load again. But the problem is, if you do that, it takes a really long time to load. I mean, if I install it to the hard drive, it might be faster, I would hope. But I guess this is just a feature of the PS3 being a Blu-ray system, especially an early Blu-ray system, is that it just takes so long for stuff to load. I mean, interminable amounts of time. And the other is that if you die and there's no restart the mission, you have to fail the mission or exit all the way out to the main menu and then go back into the game, which means lots of load times. And then there's no way to skip the dialogue between your party and whoever the enemy commander is, which means, you know, another minute or so of you hammering the X buttons, they shut the hell up. It can be really frustrating when, like, you lose the mission in the very first turn because a sniper gets a shot off. You're like, oh, I have to go through this stupid thing again. But, you know, I'm enjoying the game. I've found that it had a lot of rough spots that I imagine were probably sort of taken care of in the later 2 sequels, even though they're on the PSP, so there's probably other concerns that popped up from being on a relatively low power system. But it's enjoyable. I feel like sometimes it is a little cheap, and sometimes it sort of defies its own tactics. But, you know, I'll probably have it cleared in the next couple days. Just timing didn't work out because we recorded a day early. So, just to have something else to talk about, I popped in the other disc I got because I did a buy 2 get 1 free, and my 1 free is still in the mail. I popped in and very, very briefly looked at Ni No Kuni, which, I mean, all I could say about it, it just sort of mimics what Johnny's initial reactions were, which is that it's really pretty.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful game.
And just the amount of effort that was put into its looks are really, really unbelievable. And it's, for me, the reason I picked up that game in particular was I felt like this generation of consoles never really quite scratched the itch for the JRPG that I really had.
Yeah.
So you had games like Xenoblade, which are fairly traditional JRPGs with a relatively non-JRPG-ish combat system. You had games like The Last Story, which are not quite so traditional. And then you had on the Xbox, you had things like the Microsoft-funded games like Blue Dragon, and you had games like The Last Remnant, which is relatively traditional. Mm-hmm. But there just wasn't that many of them out there that were good. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of these mid-tier ones out there that you're like, eh.
Yeah.
But this is as a traditional by-the-book JRPG as you can find.
Right.
It is. Yeah. It is a hardcore old-school JRPG. So it's kind of nice just to, you know, put 10 minutes into the game and just say, ah, yeah, this is what I remember this genre being like.
Yeah. See, I'd like to see it side by side with Dragon Quest X, and just see how they look, you know?
So, yeah, I mean, Dragon Quest X looks a lot more 3D-ish, if that makes sense. Okay. Its art style. It's more rounded.
Okay.
It'll be interesting once, you know, I can actually play Dragon Quest X to get a real visual comparison to it. I mean, it's a gorgeous game, though.
It does really feel like, you know, it has that kind of Dragon Quest feel to it. Just from the overworld map and all that kind of stuff, it's like very much a Dragon Quest-ish kind of game.
Yeah, it's no surprise. I mean, with level 5, level 5 made Dragon Quest 8 and 9.
Yep. I think what's interesting is how they executed the art style of 2 distinct famous animators. Mm-hmm. And the games don't look like at all like they were made by the same people, and yet at the same time, you could kind of tell.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you really can't get artistically further from Studio Ghibli to Toriyama stuff. I mean, Toriyama is very simplistic character faces. I mean, he's Captain Same Face. And then you have these really expressive, emotive kinds of faces that you get out of, you know, the Ghibli stuff. Mm-hmm. The world is far more detailed in one, but the simple art style of the other is sort of part of its charm.
Yep.
And the fact they executed both of them is kind of impressive.
Yeah.
So I'll have more to report on that, and hopefully it'll be a positive experience in the way that it has been so far. But of course, it's only been 10 minutes, so you know, it is what it is. All right. So with that, I think that's going to wrap up new business for us. So stay tuned after the break, and we will wrap up our now playing for Pandora's Tower.
Now playing? Come on, you've got no playing on the brain today.
Oh!
Retroactive.
We will wrap up our round.
No prizes for guessing James' favorite segment of the show.
My favorite, least favorite segment of the show. God damn it. Stay tuned and we will wrap up our retroactive of Pandora's Tower.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a review for Fish on 3D by Kimberly Keller. Kim takes on the tough assignment of reviewing what she describes as a, quote, no-nonsense arcade-style fishing game. She rolls up her sleeve, lights up a cigar, slips into loose cannon mode, and tells us if the fishermen in our audience are going to want to break out the top-shelf lures or let this one swim away.
Jesus Christ!
And our next review is of Inazuma 11-3 Lightning Bolt by Dan Cookman. Dan plays some soccer, gives us a ribald expose of a cringeworthy voice acting and stylus controlled footy. Does this sequel build on the DS original? Read his review to find out.
Footy, Greg, footy.
Footy, yeah, very good with the colloquialisms there, John. I feel like you understand everything about European culture.
Oh,
I'm getting there. I'm close.
Neil has impressions of Skylanders Swap Force. Neil has a problem. That problem is Skylanders. Like any good act, he goes back to his dealer and gets another hit in Skylanders Swap Force. He gives you the scoop on how jumping affects the game, what he thinks of the bonus missions, and how he likes the new characters. Danny Bivens has impressions of Theatrhythm Final Fantasy Curtain Call. Danny hits the floor of Tokyo Game Show and gets some hands-on time with the sequel to Square Enix's rhythm game. He takes off his Eris cosplay long enough to fill us in on the new songs from the TGS demo and give us his take on the new physical control scheme.
All right, we also have an interview with Kirsten Gavoni, the Scribblenauts Unmasked executive producer, by Josh Max and Jared Rosenberg. Josh talks to the executive producer of Scribblenauts Unmasked to find out what the newest entry in this venerable series has to offer besides DC Comics characters. Check out our video interview. And we also have a review of Etrian Odyssey Untold, The Millennium Girl by Justin Baker. Atlas had the nerve to add story mode to an Etrian Odyssey game, and Justin had the guts to try it out. Find out how he likes the new tweaks to the usual formula in his review.
We have impressions of Geist Crusher by Danny Bivens. Danny takes off his Ada Wong cosplay long enough to give us an opinion on what he describes as, quote, the Japanese version of Skylanders, unquote. If your name isn't Neil Runahan and that doesn't interest you, maybe the fact that it's made by Capcom and Treasure will make you want to check out this promising new series. And finally, we have a feature, NWR's Top 10 Zelda Games by the whole staff. We all love Zelda games, but when it comes down to ranking which ones are the best ever, things get violent. We locked the entire staff in the octagon and had them fight to the death and came out with this list. Enjoy it. It's bathed in the blood of our writers.
Yep. Check out this and additional reviews, news, previews, impressions, and other content on the site NintendoWorldReport.com.
So, welcome back to the show. It's time to discuss Pandora's Tower, part two of our retroactive segment, not no blank, where we'll conclude our thoughts about the show, or about, we will conclude our thoughts about the game. We're especially on this segment going to focus on the second half of the game and how the game evolves from the early sort of, you know, understanding how the game plays and the early setting of vibe and how it reaches a conclusion and the tone the game takes throughout there. So if you've not listened to the first part of our discussion of Pandora's Tower yet, or if you're still early in the game and are a little concerned about the potential for some spoilers here, because we might say something, you know, that's casually spoilery, you might want to go ahead and listen to the first segment, or just kind of go ahead and come back when you've gotten a little further into the game. We won't be offended. All right, so on that note, we're going to go ahead and kick it off. So, Greg, you didn't get... I mean, obviously, you weren't here for the first half. So, yeah. I mean, you played this a little while ago. So
yeah, it was several months ago when I played it. But I did play it through to completion, got a few of the endings. So, yeah, I'm definitely be able to relay some of my experiences. But, yeah, I mean, in terms of how I kind of felt about the start of the game, just to kind of catch up with the rest of you on that part of it. Like, I mean, it definitely made like a fairly favourable early impression for me, kind of with the, just some of the tone of the game and some of the pointer mechanics and the bosses and the Zelda like structure to the dungeons, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it got off to a good start with me, definitely.
Yeah, I remember when I talked about it on the show. I mentioned getting a Zelda feel out of it, but at the same time, I kind of always felt awkward about it. Like, I was like, does this really feel like Zelda, or am I just putting it in what I know? But I'm glad to hear.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was more like God of War. That was the first thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some of that there too, isn't there? Obviously, what would distinguish it, from Zelda is the fact that you're not going to get a whole array of dungeon specific items and puzzle solving and all that. It doesn't. It's a bit more one note, and that's kind of where we start to look at the second half of the game in this segment. I guess that's where for me the limitations of it started to show up a bit.
Yeah. So about halfway through the game, it's 14 towers, right?
13. Isn't it supposed to be 13?
Yeah. So
there are 12 virtues and one thingy.
That's it. And so after spoilers, we'll just call it the thingy. After the first half of the towers, the game sort of does this weird thing I've not seen in games before and says, towers have been sort of elementally focused. And then all of a sudden it's like, guess what? Starting over. And we sort of run back through some of the same kind of environments.
Yeah, I mean, it's a set of five and then a second set of five, going over the same elements. And I mean, you say you haven't seen something like it before, but, a good example is like some of the post-Symphony of the Night Castlevania games.
That's true.
Like a Portrait of Ruin, where you go to sort of somewhat different versions of the paintings that you went to in the first half of the game, but they're the similar themes, and the layout may not be the same, but it's, kind of riffing on it, and you get, these varying degrees with the second set of towers, but some of them have, like, certain rooms or, the layouts that are clearly kind of, reminiscent of what you had in the first. So it's not just the fact that, oh well, that was the fire dungeon and here's another fire dungeon. Like they're more similar than that.
They're clearly inspired by the same kind
of
thing.
I mean, there's a whole plot kind of tie in about the fact that we've got the the male god and the female god, this, that, but that's obviously I mean it's nice that they managed to kind of write in a reason for this sort of thing, but it certainly just reminded me of the kind of not as brutal as just copy paste for the inverted castle in Symphony of the Night, but it's very much, there's plenty of Castlevania in this game. We talk about Zelda, but with using the chain and some of the stuff, so it's kind of appropriate actually that they would use a similar technique.
Yeah, it's kind of those galaxies in Super Mario Galaxy with the giant tree, and then later on, oh, here's another galaxy with a giant tree, except it's flipped and it's fall. And that's the only difference.
It's not, there are plenty of games that will do this to, maybe they had a certain goal in mind for how much game they wanted, and they're kind of struggling to make up the numbers, and then so they do some of these things. Of course, the issue here would be it's kind of that it's a bit uncomfortable as a percentage, you know, like it's about half the game that's riffing on some of these things. Now, not to overstate it again, because I mean, you get unique bosses, and then you get the sort of, well, what counts as two towers, but it is effectively one level with the light and dark one after the second set, which I understand has some real bug problems in the American version, which, as far as I know, do not exist in the European version, or I was just really lucky and didn't experience them.
So I didn't experience either, but I, of course, had the European version. So what are these, what are these bug issues?
It's something about, and I mean, Guillaume, you didn't get this far, did you? So, and you had the American version, so yeah, I mean, I think it's something that came up in the forum thread as well. But there is some sort of issue. Again, I didn't experience it firsthand, but you know, this dungeon that appears essentially the final dungeon of the game, where you've got a light tower and a dark tower, and you're flipping between them, you know, much in the style of Link to the Past or Metroid Prime 2. There's some sort of bug there. There's something triggers, some bad things happen, and you know, you might lose your progress somehow. I'm not exactly sure how it works, because like I said, I've never experienced it firsthand. But I would say for the people that were playing the American version had issues with that, that's a shame, because that's one of my, I mean, some of it's just after having played through the same elemental sequence again, it's nice to have something fresh, you know. It's kind of, but it was one of my favorite parts of the game, and the thought of, you know, people kind of slogging through some of that repeat stuff to then get to that part but have it spoiled by the bug, that's really unfortunate. I was sad to read about that.
So is this a save destroying bug? Because
appears that it has something to do with the crimson doors in those towers.
Right.
And if it loads, like, they don't open or something like that.
Oh, that would suck.
Which, that would suck pretty bad.
Really suck.
So it sounds like, you know, it does only affect the North American version, at least based on what they're saying.
I don't understand that, really, because, I mean, how much reprogramming could there have been?
Not much. I mean, I mean, of course, we don't understand what happens when you convert a game from a PAL to a NTSC. I mean,
but I mean, these days, even when, you know, for instance, when I'm running it, you know, on my TV, I'm running it in 60 hertz. Almost.
I mean, I ran it on my TV in 60 hertz.
Yeah, that was the European version that you imported. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really kind of shoddy that happened, but I'm guessing for this to even be economic to release at all at the stage of the Wii's life that it came out, it was a pretty low rent operation, so it's not exactly shocking, but at the same time, it's somewhat disappointing.
It's a little surprising, yeah. It sounds like people in the thread avoided it through just using Let's Plays and stuff. So, which I'm glad they were aware that it existed beforehand, because that would suck. Oh, actually, John, you weren't present for the last segment either.
No.
So. Real quick, how far did you get first?
I didn't get very far at all.
Okay, well, how many towers did you clear?
I got to the second tower, basically.
Oh my god,
I wasn't able to go very far in it.
All right. Anyway, how did you feel about the first 6 minutes of the game, John?
Not that bad.
I mean, I liked it. It was really good. My first thought was, why the heck didn't Nintendo of America want to bring it over?
Stop eating, John. Have some respect for your
editor. I was about to say, John,
have some respect for your editor. I can say this.
Are you eating the
now.
Flesh of monsters, John? Because if you're not, you'd best stop chewing.
I'm done.
That had better been a beast heart, John.
It was.
Okay, we're good then.
Yeah, I mean, my first thought was, you know, why didn't, it kind of blends so many popular styles of games that really don't come to the Wii typically, and I was just wondering why Nintendo of America didn't want to bring it over.
So do you think maybe that was part of the reason? Like, it would to me, this game feels like it would be really hard to market. There's so much stuff in here, and I mean, you could use the approach that some games use, which is just bleat you over the head with cinematics. But the cinematics in this game are both a mixture of just absolute Disturbia. and I mean, obviously, it's on the Wii, so the visuals aren't going to be that tremendously impressive.
Yeah, but I mean, to me, it's very. I was expecting something a lot weirder and a lot more Japanese, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I mean, it was a Gambarion game.
Gambarion do a lot of fighting games, one-on-one fighting games.
Yeah, Naruto games or something.
But yeah, they've ventured outside of fighting games, but that's kind of their thing. And then, you know, like I said, so this is a bit more ambitious for them. And like I said, I was kind of impressed, definitely in the first part of the game, the way that, you know, they kind of straddled some of these different styles. Like, so you got a bit of that character action, third-person brawler kind of stuff going on. You got some Zelda in there, some Castlevania. You know, you can kind of, but it would have been tough to kind of pick what angle you want to go with marketing-wise. If they were actually going to really, you know, try and make a big deal out of it. But I mean, it just seems like there were a number of games that Nintendo of America didn't want to take the effort to localize. But Nintendo of Europe did take up that option, and then it becomes a different equation after that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there was just a surprising amount of depth there. I mean, there was a lot more to it, like, you know, in terms of upgrading stuff and, you know, buying and selling stuff. And
we never even touched on the upgrade system.
Yeah, giving gifts and all of that kind of stuff. And there was a lot more going on than I expected. I expected it to be fairly, you know, just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So
quite a lot to get to grips with at first, too, because you've got the dating sim kind of aspects of the game.
A little bit. You're dating a hideous monster beast. Yeah.
Yeah. All that kind of. So it's. But the
there's also the concept of day and night there as well, where there's certain things in the towers that you can only get, you know, during the day or in the morning and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of like little.
So real quick, I want to bring in a comment from the forums, which is actually from Tyson, who is one of the co-founders of Operation Rainfall, and he talks a bit about how when they were first, you know, hyping all three games, there was some feedback from, you know, fans who were supportive of the general effort, but who just felt like they should be focusing on The Last Story and Xenoblade in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of a weak link. He said, Pandora's Tower is perhaps the hardest of the 3D campaign for, as there simply wasn't enough information. In fact, much of the information that was available contradicted what little else there was. Around the time the game launched in Europe, they initiated Pandora's Tower Month in order to raise awareness of why we thought the game looked promising. And I mean, I could see why people's immediate feedback to the game was that, you know, why waste your effort on this?
Well, it almost seemed like a self-fulfilling prophecy, because I only heard that it was the weakest link. You know, every time those three titles came up, it was like, this is a weak link, this is a weak link. But these people had never played it. It had never played any of the games.
It's because, I mean, it didn't have a name developer behind it the way that, you know, you look at Xenoblade, you've got Monolith, and then obviously you have that story, the connection there. So, I mean, you could see...
And here you've got the One Piece guys.
Also, when you describe the game, you have to get meat for this girl or else she turns into
vegan.
A monster.
You have to force feed this religious vegan meat.
Yeah, there's like this whole kind of like smoke screen sort of thing above the game that makes you think that it's a lot weirder than it actually is.
And I'm sure, I mean, just, you know, in terms of looking at it in media and all that, you know, it doesn't have the same kind of production values necessarily. It certainly is like The Last Story. You know, so it was, I mean, it's interesting that it did end up getting kind of bundled in with those, because it's not as much of an RPG, you know, as some of the others may be in this, that, and the other, but, you know, it's got quite a lot going for it, I think, but it's stuff that's difficult to kind of, to sell. And but that's why I think probably for me when I was getting it, I hadn't necessarily even intended on buying it. I was actually just, I'd heard some good things and some of the similarities to series I like Castlevania and Zelda kind of intrigued me and the premise was interesting. But I was just like going around a supermarket where normally the only games they would have would be like, you know, Wii branded stuff and the occasional sports game or something, and there's just Pandora's Tower in its black case sitting there for half price. I was just kind of looked at it and thought, why not? and that's how I ended up playing it. And so right off the bat, it did kind of exceed some of my expectations, perhaps just based on the fact that I hadn't invested a lot in the game, you know, before buying it.
I think a lot of people, I mean, are just reading through the forums, and I remember my initial reaction to it was kind of being surprised by the depth of it all. KSO commented that the gameplay in the towers seems, at least initially, like a simple hack and slash game, but the chain mechanics add depth to the combat, and with the Wii remote and the control, that ends up working really well. He also notes that there's time management involved in the towers, which gives it kind of Majora's Mask vibes,
and that that mechanic is an interesting part of the game, and taking care of the girl at the hub stages, which contributes to the game time management. He said, although it does get repetitive, he said a lot of the enemy designs reminded him of things from like an Ys game, mm-hmm. and that it's just playing the game made him feel kind of like a Falcom game. So, which I
see that.
Yeah,
I didn't see that until I read his comment and then spent some time looking at character art, because I have the Super Deluxe Premium Edition with the art, with the spell book and the art. So I just and leaf through it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, he's right. There's some stuff here that did you look at and you go, yeah.
There is some E7, I think, in this game. Just the flow of the combat, and you have to dodge more than block. Like, you have to be constantly attacking. Yeah, I can kind of see it.
Yeah, it's very kinetic. You have to keep moving.
I think the interesting part of it is that, you know, you get all this different stuff kind of straight away, and it seems like, oh yeah, you know, there's quite a lot to this, but then it doesn't develop that much. I think that's really kind of the main thing that I noticed about the game, even beyond the whole issue of the level design kind of repetition that we talked about. It's like your techniques don't really expand very much. You know, the combat is so simple that it's not like you get a bunch of different moves like later in the game, really. I mean, big fan of stuff like where I play stuff like Castlevania Lords of Shadows, like, oh, well, you get even more flashy combos. Like, I'm not that big of a fan of that kind of progression anyway.
Sometimes you'll get a combo right at the end of the game and you can use it like once.
I mean, I'm not, to be honest, I don't really have much regard for that kind of stuff anyway, but it's not like you get that in this, you know. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it pretty much sticks to the same kind of formula throughout.
Well, one thing we also haven't touched on is the weapon changing. So as the game goes on,
did you change your weapon at all?
So obviously you have to use the chain some, and you have to use the twin blade some, the scythe for some things. I almost exclusively used the sword.
Yeah.
I felt like that gave me a good middle ground.
Yeah, and that's kind of a pet peeve of mine in games where they give you one weapon at the beginning of the game, they ask you, please upgrade this, and you do, and then much later you get some secondary weapon. And what the fuck do I do with my first weapon now? Am I supposed to upgrade this one as well? And I find it very hard, in my case, to kind of switch priorities and upgrade them all, you know, for them to be all at the same level.
I never really get too involved in that kind of thing. And to be honest, I know the combat isn't really nuanced enough to make you feel like, oh, well, let's experiment and do this. You know, you kind of have something that works, you just stick with it. That was my sort of feeling on it there. So, I mean, technically certain kind of depths, I guess, that I didn't plumb there with upgrades, but I don't know whether that has really a substantive effect on gameplay anyway.
So, in the new game plus is where you gain access to these red doors.
Yeah.
And one of the weapons you can get from the red doors, and while I have never used them, I've watched video of somebody just playing the game with it, is this cannon that shoots explosive stakes out of it.
What?
Yeah, it's incredibly slow but it's so powerful, and just seeing him use it in the game, like, even if you haven't beaten the game, you need to go watch somebody do a playthrough with it on YouTube, because it's amazing.
So is the whole idea that you can just come in and clear a room?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
like, pretty
I only
much
watched...
just like without even moving.
Like, he just blasts and he just takes stuff out.
Yeah.
It's kind of unbelievable and stupid and amazing and wonderful. It's a little gimme for people who play the game again. And I think, you know, we spoke a bit about the fact the game has multiple endings, so it does obviously want you to play them again, although you don't necessarily need to replay the entire game to do that.
No, not at all. I mean, it gives you kind of options for parts of the game that you want to kind of re-go over again.
Right.
At which point, you can go to some of those red rooms and get some more stuff. And it really depends, because all the endings are tied to the affinity level that you build up with Elena.
Which takes forever to build.
If you get close at the end. You know,
she's
like,
worth it, Guillaume. She's worth it.
If you get close at the end, I mean, for me, the way I kind of played it, I played really conservatively in terms of not getting to a point where her meter would start going down. Mm-hmm. Right. So I just gradually built it up and up. Didn't quite get it high enough for the best ending, the S-class ending.
Which is weird, a weird ending in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about the content of the endings a bit later.
Right.
But, I mean, in terms of just, you know, like, you know, that's kind of the goal of the game, or what you may say a secondary goal of the game, other than just beating all the bosses,
right.
Is, mm-hmm. you know, maintaining and improving that relationship meter. And so I was close to the top, but not quite there. And then pretty much once you... gives you the option to kind of, okay, now pick a part where you can replay again and start boosting that meter even further up. I pretty much just did the final part again and just did a few other things. You gave her a few extra things and whatnot, and then I was there. But if you hadn't played that way, if you'd been a bit more loose about managing the relationship, you could go further, you're halfway through the game, something like that, and then, you know, with some of these fancy weapons that you get that James was talking about, or some of the other items that you're going to give these sort of new game plus sort of treats, you could probably rack up that relationship meter a lot faster than they would have done the first time, and therefore maybe still see some of the other endings without too much extra
work. I want to say the worst ending, you actually don't even complete the game.
No, the worst ending is just her killing you, isn't it?
Oh, well, the worst, like, a game, not like, oh, you've lost, go back to your save point. And I want to say, like, if your relationship with her is really, really, really bad,
it still doesn't trigger the actual, like, the end sequence.
About two-thirds of the game, two-thirds of the way through the game, you give her a piece of Master Flesh, and it's just like, no, it's too late, and she basically has you kill her.
I have not seen that one.
Which you actually have to do. You have to press the button that kills her.
Awesome.
Oh.
I've got maybe four towers left, and the gauge that that shows your relationship is kind of fuzzy, right? Like, I'm not exactly sure where I'm at on it, but I'm just over halfway up, I think. Like, is that normal? Because I've been restarting.
Sounds like you're tracking pretty well. I mean, that's a, 'cause the thing is, you can get like a certain items and things that you know, maybe a bit later on will kind of, I did anyway. I don't know if it's just pure happenstance, but it really started kind of getting up in big chunks towards the end. So,
oh, okay.
I mean, like, how often do they just give you something? 'Cause I noticed right at the start, they kind of give you stuff that's like, hey, this is a gift. Like, how often do they do that?
So sometimes you find stuff in the dungeon. The things that you have her translate, those are actually really good for your relationship.
Yeah, very good.
And sometimes you find items that... Sometimes Mavda will just sell them to you.
Right, and you can craft some
items. Yeah, so if you built up money, you could start buying things. Or if you've got a bunch of items that are kind of junk items, but you could use them to craft other stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, so when you get towards the end of the... When you get towards the end of the game, you may find like money and stuff left over, and then if you bother to think about it, you could find ways to really get that in relationship.
And I've been doing that, but I feel like I've been doing that for the whole game, and it's starting to get a little bit tiring trying to improve that relationship. And
it creeps up slowly, but you can wreck it quickly, and that's actually not that far from reality, unfortunately. but it's, I think being at about halfway at that point is pretty normal, because like Greg Carrick said, there's some opportunities for big ones late in the game. Now, whether or not you're tracking for the S ranking, I'm not sure. Yeah. That you may be a little off from that, because you have to be on it.
Right. I've been crafting her gifts. I've been buying her stuff. She's got a field full of flowers and
fucking women. God,
yeah.
It sounds so funny to describe it. I've been trying really hard, but she just doesn't understand me.
She just all she ever does is like, oh, thanks, and dismissively waves her extra tentacle.
Some days he just wants to watch football. I get it, Aaron. I get it.
You don't get clues as to how she's feeling, until pretty late. Like,
well,
only...
she's turning into a monster. She's not feeling great.
Sure, but like only recently has she started to. Sometimes, like, you'll see her wave at you as you're going to a tower, and then she says to herself, "Oh, Aaron," you know, and she looks sad. But only recently has she started looking upbeat. So I don't know if it's because of the story, like the point at which...
No, I would imagine it's just because of the relationship meet, like, you know.
Yeah, right. I'm pretty sure...
So it would have been nice to get some more confirmation that, okay, you're on the right track, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
something that's kind of more trackable.
I mean, I think the little conversations you can have with her are really your indicator. I mean, she gives you stuff too. Mm-hmm. I mean, she does occasionally give you things, if I recall correctly.
Yeah,
she does.
And the stuff you get is kind of your indicator that things are going well,
mm-hmm.
Or they're not. So, I mean, to me, just getting her all the things to translate is really a big step in the right direction.
Yeah,
and that was mostly my focus. And even then, she was progressing well. If that's a terrible way of putting it. but it is kind of weird that there's that dating sim mechanics just sort of built on top of a story. And for those of you looking to pull it off, Enter has some commentary on it. He talks a bit about the red doors and he says really they aren't worth the trouble of going through the lockup glitch. But he said, on unlocking the endings are based on the affinity meter, and there's a great guide on GameFAQs, and he has a link for it. Basically, you can gift an item, such as a brass fangs or strange grains, repeatedly to tank the affinity between Aaron and Elena. But dropping the affinity is extremely quick, while raising affinity is extremely slow. So if you want to experience the five endings yourself, just go high and then just tank it. And then run. and you can just sort of see them all in succession. Mm-hmm. He actually spoils all the endings and describes them. I only saw what he describes as the sort of B ending, which is really unsatisfying ending where this enemy that the game really hasn't implied exists at all sort of shows up. Greg, what's the first real mention of this guy?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because when you're in this second half of the game, like I said, you know, gameplay wise, not a lot's happening. And then,
right.
You know, so, I mean, it would help if you're kind of positively invested in maintaining the relationship meter, because that's kind of, you know, one of the more dynamic things that's going on at this point, I guess. But, and I mean, the bosses are still good and all that. So, I mean, it's not like I was mm-hmm. really struggling to play. I was still enjoying it, but it certainly, you know, the freshness had kind of worn off at this point. But what you're also getting is, you know, every so often you give her the big pieces of flesh, you know, that come from the bosses, you get these little flashbacks to,
right.
Not flashbacks to her own life, but to someone else's life, like a past life or something. You know, you're not sure what they, you know, they're quite cryptic and, you know, you're not really sure what they have to do with anything, frankly. So that's like one of the strands of kind of intrigue in the second half of the game. Oh, it's, you know, runs through all of the game, but certainly once you get to the second half, it kind of gets more interesting. Like, how is it connecting all up and all that? And I guess the real point is that the way the endings are, you know, if you want some of that stuff explained, you really kind of need to get the S-class ending, the top ending.
Yeah, that's the only one that gives you all the details.
Yeah, like, all the other ones are so, like, I mean, the first ending I got was A, so I got some stuff explained, and,
right.
You know, it was surely, you know, kind of more of a fitting resolution to the story than probably some of the lesser ones are, that either seem incomplete or just downbeat. But really, it's only the S ending where it's like, okay, you know, this is like the real ending. You know, it's not just like it's a spectrum of kind of good or bad endings or just alternate endings. Like, it really is a feeling like, okay, this is the one that gives you the information about the story you've been kind of wondering about, you know, and really pays off everything as much as it can be kind of paid off. And probably that is in part, like, because it's leaving it to the end, you know, I guess perhaps as a carrot for people to maybe, if they find the other endings unsatisfying, it's going to make them, or, you know, induce them to go back and raise the affinity and do it. But because it leaves it to the end, it's kind of a big dump, you know, like, okay, here's information in your lap in a big way.
I mean, the real protagonist, antagonist of the game, like, the creature that is ultimately responsible for all of this shit going down is introduced basically at the very end of the game. I mean, there's some indication of stuff's going on. Some of the translated texts have some information there. Some of the notes you find in the dungeon have some information there. But really, the actual introduction of the big bad happens pretty much right at the end. And it's not even a great introduction, depending on your ending. In some cases, they just show up. They're like, sup, let's go. And you have to fight them. In some cases, it's a whole different experience.
Yeah.
Their play in there is, its role is actually really intriguing. It just feels like they did a really bad job of playing that up.
Right. And I did watch a video on YouTube of the best ending, and I kind of thought, oh, did I miss something here? Like, I couldn't find
it. It shows up. I mean, that's accurate memory, isn't it, Greg? That it's sort of like...
From what I recall, like I said, it's a lot of stuff that gets dumped on you. Okay, so basically, you know, all these sort of hints and little fragments that we've been showing you throughout the course of the story, this is what all that stuff was about, and you're getting it as part of the, you know, the S class package, you know, that's it. So, I mean, it is a reward, you know, I mean, it's kind of nice.
It's just like, whoa, hey.
It is definitely a reward that, you know, that's kind of nice for the people that did invest in that process of getting the affinity meter up and everything to see that, to get it up. And, you know, I mean, the story is not great in how it's told sometimes. Like I said, I think this exposition dump at the end is inelegant, to say the least.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I was definitely interested to see what some of that stuff was about, you know, why we were getting the glimpses of the kind of the past life and this little sort of this.
There's a lot of lore. There's a lot more lore in this game than I expected. So see, that wrap up is pretty cool.
And it's got this kind of this basically is a subplot about another couple sometime in the past, you know, and you just like, you know, what does this happen? You know, I did want to know what that was about. And like I said,
it's not just tangential either. I mean, there's a connection that
out, yeah, there is a connection. But like I said, they save it for the best ending, really. And, you know, I think they probably could have graded it maybe like, you know, a bit held less back, you know, like given you a bit more information during the course of it, just would have helped the storytelling in general. But like I said, I don't know whether they were kind of caught between, you know, how to tell the story and how to offer these things as kind of, you know, strata for people to aim for, and as game design and incentives, you know, I think the two may be kind of rubbed up against each other a little awkwardly in this case.
To be honest, maybe I would feel differently if I had been working, you know, to get that ending. And I still plan to finish the game myself. But I felt like the story was mostly effective when it was told through these kind of memos and these desolate places and these ruins. The game as a whole kind of has this post-apocalyptic vibe to it. Mm-hmm. These towers that have been abandoned, everyone is dead, and you're just exploring them years after the fact, and you're trying to discover what's going on here. And yeah, like the ending is very much focused on these visions that the woman has had, and that's not really what I found intriguing about the plot. You know, like
I mean, so the very end, the very last bit where you meet this, this second couple's plot starts to become, you know, it unwinds very quickly, where the role of the towers becomes very immediately apparent beyond what they're told initially. It all starts to make sense why they've made this area kind of a closed military zone. Like, what, you're just not allowed to go there. It's more than just, it's not safe, although it definitively isn't safe. There's things going on there that were basically just says, like, you understand. A, the people in charge knew more about this tower than they ever possibly let on. And B, they also had no idea what the hell they were dealing with. And you kind of get the same feeling when you're there, because everyone except for Mavda seems absolutely stunned by what's going on. I mean, ultimately, it's kind of this very sharp pivot where plot dump goes on and everybody's relationship to everything else is sort of recontextualized.
Yeah.
Even Aaron, who ostensibly often just feels like he's just the poor sod who ended up falling in love with this girl, his role in the grand narrative becomes considerably better defined in some of these endings.
Right. Although he never really becomes a
character.
No, he's a little bit silent protagonist-y for so much of it. Yeah. It's kind of hard to accept anything that's imposed on him beyond that, you know?
Like, but he does, yeah. I mean, he does pivot in some of the endings.
There's definite differences in the, you know, in the resolution and how it pertains to his character, and some of the other characters too. Like, you know, Mavda's a kind of ambiguous character through a lot of it. You're kind of like, well, she's creepy and, you know, all this stuff. Like, do you trust her? Do you not? And across the spectrum of the endings, she comes across differently, you know, like, right. In some of them it seems like she was more of a bad character, or at least not a particularly caring one, and then, you right. know, on the other end of the spectrum it's more like, oh no, you know, she was quite nice. It's kind of weird, like, is that that, yeah, you know, was it that, well, by your relationship being more rock solid that she kind of bought into you more, or is it, you know, I'm not sure why she
yeah,
seems
I mean,
like a different
the
character.
Way I read it was the conditions on the ground essentially dictated her final ending.
How she kind of responded to it, yeah. You know? So,
because the big bad, as it were, I mean, how they enter the scene is directly affected by how bad Elena's corruptions become. So, in some instances, that final threat is a considerably weaker being than it would be in other instances where it's just an unkillable monster and they have to just sort of mitigate the problem. And it seems like Mavda's response is dictated by these sort of pivots in the story as a whole, where in some cases she's quite willing to sell you out if it sort of alleviates the problem, but she's also quite willing to assist you if that resolves the situation as well. So the whole time playing the game, I was convinced she was going to stab me in the back.
Yeah.
Like, the whole game seemed to be setting it up for her to come around and go, like, actually, I was the one turning her ass into a monster. Guess what? That flesh just made her stronger. And, like, there was this constant pivot where I was just expecting her at any minute to just snap her fingers, and I was going to have to kill Elena. And she's going to turn into this big, nasty, earth-killing monster. But a lot of times, as you watch the different endings, they're all... They pivot, her role pivots in them quite a bit, but ultimately she still seems driven by the singular reality of the situation.
No,
which
I mean,
is,
oh, it's, I mean, you know, sort of a spoiler, but she's never like behind it all or anything like that.
She's always actively trying to stop it. It's just she may not care definitively about what your end fate is. There's a bigger issue she's dealing with.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, one of the problems I would have with the way it's just like the connection to like the wider world, and there's this war going on and all this kind of stuff. It feels very distended from that, you know. Like,
so have you watched the sea ending?
I don't think I've seen that.
The
one.
Sea ending wraps that is a weird one because it actually pulls the wider world back into it. So I don't want to spoil it too much, but in that case, the big baddest is taken care of, but the war becomes more of the pressing part of the ending.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what I have grasped about the spectrum of the endings is it's pretty much just there to, you know, prove to us all that love conquers all. Like, it's just like, well, by the strength of their bond, that every, like,
oh,
not just,
go,
you know.
Go watch ending C and feel how much love conquered all.
Yeah, but that's
because
they didn't love each other that much in that, you know, yeah. The affinity, that's the whole point. In C, the affinity isn't that high, so their kind of not that powerful love cannot save the entire country from war and ruin. Whereas when you get to
didn't give her enough meat.
When you get to S, when you get to the S rank, you know, their love is just so powerful that everyone around them is better. And
it's kind of made explicit too visually, because every time that your bond grows, there's these golden filaments that surround you, and in that best ending, like, these filaments just strengthen the chain and make it so that you can save her, you know, at the last second.
And I mean, the whole chain thing, you know, the imagery and the symbol is not subtle or anything like that, but, you know, so it's it's a pretty trite sort of theme, but, you know, I think the general weirdness of some of the content and all that helps to mitigate how well-traveled, you know, that idea is, like, just the fact that how it kind of manifests itself in this bizarre sort of context with all the monsters and the fantasy history and all that. So it does, the story, you know, was not the main thing that I took from the game. I think, you know, the main thing I took from the game is probably, you know, some of those, Zelda, Castlevania sort of influences playing out nicely, and definitely the boss design. But, you know, I think it has its merits, and it does draw you in more than it, you know, would done if there wasn't any sort of investment in that part of the story. You know, I mean, they clearly, you know, considered it a priority in the development, and you know, there's thought there. It's just not necessarily that skillfully done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so... I'll pull one more quote in to kind of bring it back to, you know, what we said really is part of the game that I really enjoy. It kind of feeds back here is, Chuckles had an observation that that the high point are the boss battles, and each had its own clever hook. To me, and, you know, he discusses more about how they all work out differently. And to me, that was really the best parts of the game. It was just, I mean, I enjoyed the sort of creepy vibe. But I really felt like this part, like going out and just doing these battles was, you could kind of tell that's where these developers had, you know, worked in the past.
Yeah, well, the boss battles were puzzles, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I probably played at least recently the least, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
for John.
You did play it longest ago, yeah.
I mean, I've replayed some just for the show, but I'm trying to think. There's a boss where... It's relatively late where you had to chain down part of its body, I believe, to hit it. And I just remember thinking, like, whoa, this is really cool. And, wow, this chain is super creepy at the same time.
Yeah, like, I mean, what impressed me about it is the fact that, like I said, because, you know, unlike a Zelda game, you know, most of the time when you have a boss, and, you know, there's plenty of good Zelda bosses, but a lot of them are built around, you know, the item that you get in that dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, when you're talking about sort of, you know, 3D Zelda like Twilight Princess, where it got really specific, like where, okay, you know, this dungeon, this item,
the stupid top,
the spinner, you know, it's all like,
yeah. As soon as you walk in there, you're like, what do I have?
It's all
to
really
this?
Built around that and that alone, right? But of course, with Pandora's Tech, because you never really get any of that stuff. So it's all how they managed to take, you know, the same core abilities all the time and make new sort of puzzle bosses around them. You know, there's quite a lot of them in all the different towers. And
right.
You know, most of them bring something to the table. It's like, oh, you know, unlike the actual dungeons that lead up to them, this isn't just like some remixed version of something I did earlier on. Or, you know, they do feel unique and like they have, you know, thoughtful design put into them. And so, yeah, that's really, that is what sustained me through the process, no doubt. I just wanted to see what they were going to come up with.
Although some actions really repeat, you pretty much know that you're going to have to rip off parts of the monster before
you can expose
its weak point.
Right.
There's definitely, you know, there's definitely going to be some repetition there with obviously like the whole tugging at the core sort of mechanic, you know, kind of building up the charge on the chain and then ripping at it, you know, when you get a chance and all that. I mean, there's some similarities there, but I had my doubts about whether they were going to be able to keep doing things to make them interesting, you know, especially getting into that second half. But I think they kind of performed above my expectations overall going from start to finish.
So one thing that I was kind of thinking about as I played the boss battles and as I replayed the first two bosses for the show, the chain itself, using it as a weapon to literally just gut these bosses. I mean, quite literally, you are gutting them. Using this chain that seems to, you know, almost magically wrap around vital organs in exactly the right way to yank them out. It really made the chain itself seem very creepy. Like, as a weapon, it seemed... I mean, there are multiple times the chain itself seems kind of living. Like, Mavda kind of talks about it a little bit. But as a weapon, it's weirdly personable. Like, it gets into things in ways where you're just like, ooh, this is kind of unsettling.
Yeah, I was impressed how it seemed to have a good weight to it. You know, like it has a really good feel to it. Like you really feel like you're actually digging into something and then pulling something out of it.
But it didn't feel like you're whipping it either. It felt like it's going to a target where it knows it needs to go.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is I thought the whole kind of zooming in thing was interesting because it's sort of it gets you kind of up close and personal with what you're actually hitting. You know, you have to zoom in and target it. And you're like, okay, you see that right there? I'm going to hit that right there. And you get to see close up the boss. Like usually with any boss battle, you're like pretty much trying to stay as far away from the boss as you possibly can.
And it's usually zoomed out because you're usually smaller.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's a kind of, because there's a lot of fixed cameras in the game. You know, again, yeah. Like John sort of about God of War, you know, the obvious similarity there. Yeah, so certain points of the game, yeah, you might be really small because they want to show certain things, or because there's almost like a point and click aspect with the chain in terms of like you can pick up. Item drops from crates and stuff without really being that close. You can just, you know, sort of almost vacuum it up with the chain. And so that zoom feature lets you sort of pinpoint specific parts of the environment if you wanted to get something while not breaking the whole fixed camera system. I mean, that's really what it's there for. And it's pretty, I like that. I like the fact that you could just sort of go through, you know, these dungeons and, you know, instead of like, you know, like having to really sort of go out of your way to like destroy pots or something like you might do in a Zelda game, you can kind of do it all remotely because this chain will just pretty much reach very far, if not, you know, not everywhere, but, you know, and you could just destroy stuff, pick stuff up, all just with that rapidity and fluidity of the Wii pointer, which is, I've always been very fond of games that leverage that to their advantage, and this certainly does.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier to do the kind of tedious tasks of, you know, opening crates, picking it up, because usually if you do it with your sword, you have to like, you know, smash it, you pick
physical
it out,
proximity,
smash it.
Isn't it? Then go to the next one, and then, you know, you can be thorough in this game without having to, but in a much more sort of streamlined way. I appreciated all that kind of stuff. It just felt, it did feel a bit sort of snappier as a result. All those sort of aspects that you find in games like, you know, some of the 3D Castlevanias or Zeldas.
Yeah, I feel like the combat in this game is actually probably better than a lot of the Zelda games. Just enemy to enemy, it feels more visceral. It's not a lot of, all right, dodge, 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 dodge. All right, Z button, I win. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the enemies themselves, I mean, the combat maybe not as polished, but the enemies themselves present more of a challenge. And there's more thought you have to put into hitting them.
I always like when you can bring the chain into play. Like, all right, let's, you know, chain a couple of enemies together for the hell of it, or, you know, do a couple of just to kind of mitigate, break up the just the button bash part of it. You know, because, I mean, you get charge moves and stuff like that. There's a little bit of timing in there, you know, but it's pretty basic stuff in that regard. But every now and again, there's something that you can do where just certain types of enemies could be quite dangerous, but if you could, do something with the chain, like, you know, they might be wielding a big, sword thing that really do a lot of damage if they get it, but you can rip it out of their hands and just throw it away or throw it back at them, you know, and stuff like that. So that certainly, again, some of the novelty of this kind of stuff wears off as it goes on, but at least in the initial stages, you know, these are some of the things that, kind of made an impression on me about it feeling. So, yeah, even though, in fairly, you know, well-traveled kind of ground, this character action kind of stuff felt a bit fresh.
Hmm. Yeah, have you guys used at all the function to chain two enemies together and have them share damage? You know, like you hit one and the other gets damage as well. It was really hard to use for some reason. I couldn't get the chain to last at all.
I think it's, well, that's always a concern, but I think part of it's just practice. I mean, so to me, you know, I was saying the chain sort of feels alive sometimes. And actually, I'd forgotten about chaining them together until Greg mentioned it. It feels very serpentine when you basically launched it at two enemies.
I mean, it's another part of the sort of ambiguous part of nature of the game. You know, there's a lot of ambiguity in the game before it before it devolves into Love Conquers All. You know, like I said, Mavda's an ambiguous character. What you're doing is ambiguous. I know this is something you kind of brought up on the first time.
Are you really doing the right thing?
Yeah, you brought it up on the first segment of Retroactive about this game. You know, you're kind of like, yeah, you know, is this a good idea? Is this going to solve anything? You know, and
are these monsters here for a fucking reason?
Yeah, and then the chain itself, it's such a brutal weapon. It's a weird thing to have as a hero's weapon. You know, like normally you think of a hero's weapon and it's a bit more pure, or you know, a great shining.
Right, it's a gleaming white sword.
But Greg, Mevda's tribe has been using chains to heal people.
Yeah, and she looks evil as shit.
Yeah, exactly right.
Exactly. So that's the thing. All of that kind of, you know, it does. I think to me, along with like some of the flashback stuff and all that, yeah, there's it adds to a certain element of intrigue of like, okay, you know, they've built this up as kind of an ambiguous thing. You know, how is that going to pay off? You know, is it going to be the kind of the downer, kind of sting in the tail ending, or is actually everything going to turn out right in the end? And of course, as it turns out, well,
it tries to have its cake.
It does have its cake in it because it runs the gamut based on how high you get that affinity meter.
Yeah, I would really suggest if you've got one and don't have the time to just play through the game to get the others, you should really see C, and then the worst ending. I can't remember what the worst ending's letter is. Is it D? I think it's D.
I think so, but I'm not sure.
Which is most of them, obviously. But, like, it gives you a pretty good gamut, because A is a pretty good-ish ending.
Yeah.
I mean, S is a better ending, obviously, outcome-wise, and it explains more. But A sort of explains some and doesn't give everything away. C doesn't explain much of anything, but it's super fucked up.
Yeah,
and the worst ending is really just so you can see how completely just depressing this game is willing to go. I mean, the fact that it actually makes you kill her is pretty messed up. I mean, there's an ending where you kill her. It's pretty screwed up all around.
Yeah, it's kind of unsurprising though.
No, it really isn't. And, you know, if it was in any other game, I think it'd be just like, why?
Yeah, but you're like, okay, well, I have been feeding her the meat of dead animals this entire time, so...
Well, and that's another thing that's ambiguous. Are these dead animals, or were these dead people?
True.
Yeah, because that's, again, you know, some of the
actually, it's... Yeah, it's not that ambiguous, because you get notes from different people, like, about all the masters, and they... Mm-hmm. I think they're all human.
Yeah, that whole process, again, it ties into like the most explained ending about what was going on there, doesn't it? But yeah, there's plenty of reason to think that they're not just monsters, or certainly they weren't always monsters, you know. So again, you're adding to that, you know, sort of feel of, and it's obviously been done in other games like Shadow of the Colossus and stuff, that, you know, like, you I don't know why I'm killing these things, but you know, I'm just doing it as a means to an end. But that doesn't mean it's like in itself a good thing to do.
Right.
To that point, I mean, the game never really gets out of its creepiness. The endings.
Yeah, but don't you think that the super duper ending is kind of off character in a way?
In the full gamut of endings, a bit, but.
Because
I
kind of feel like it doesn't have its place that they would live happily ever after this game. There's just something so ominous about the whole mood.
I mean, I would think that this experience would be so traumatic for the both of them, even if they managed to deal with the big bad.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be able to go live a happy life in the countryside afterwards. But I don't know that the game ever implies that they do. Mm. I think all right, they're able to be together now without the ever-present risk he's going to wake up one day in a pool of, like,
but it's all
like that
there is sort of implications for the wider world as well. Like, oh, it's going to be peaceful now, and this, you know. So,
right.
That was a bit much for me, you know. Like, and also just the fact that it was an ending that explained as much as it did. I mean, again, you know, like, I was kind of... happy with the game. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want stuff to go completely unexplained because you just feel like that's kind of a cheat, you know?
Yeah.
Like, right. You know, why pepper these elements, you know, along the way, and then never pay them off. But on the other hand, to kind of just put it all out there kind of felt a bit out of character because it had been cryptic and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it definitely felt like a bit obligatory as a best mm-hmm. ending. You know, it was just like, okay, well, this is the one where it turns out well and you have all your questions answered and there you go. You know, it felt kind of not just like a point along a spectrum compared to the other ones, but this is kind of an outlier, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think they could have resolved it in such a way where they could say, okay, war really did end, but I mean, they'd have to then tie back the root cause of all this to being sort of a root cause of general sort of strike.
They would have to
really
do more
do
setup, you know? Like, yeah. Again, I mean, it just for me, the balance was off in terms of, you know, how much you set these elements up. But I get, you know, like I said, I think that was part of, you know, them. It may have just been laziness in storytelling. There's always that, you know. mm-hmm. Plot exposition dumps generally tend to be that way, yeah. You know.
Just wrapping
yeah,
it
I mean,
up
to
cleanly.
To a certain extent, I understand that if they revealed too much too soon, it would tie their hands a bit. Maybe they wouldn't be able to run this full spectrum. But
yeah,
I mean,
that's right,
because
that's why they can diverge as much as they do, the endings, because right. they haven't like committed to as much things along the way.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they don't introduce the root cause of the problem until you've already determined what ending you're getting is pretty messed up.
And again, some of those things I think could have, some plot points or certain story moments could have been used to punctuate that second half of the game more effectively.
Yes, which just drags.
Because again, like I said, it's a bit of, especially just, you know, before you get to the light and dark bit, yeah, that feels like pure just kind of, okay, I'm waiting for something to happen at this point. You know, I'm enjoying doing the bosses and all that, but it's just like, okay, you know, I'm going through the motions a bit here. What's going to happen? And the, you know, you don't get that, apart from the little hints with the flashbacks, you don't get too right. much to sort of keep you know, guessing and whatnot in that phase. So I definitely would have liked to see the balance tipped a bit to, you know, more layering
definitely.
It as you go rather than the big dump. There's just no doubt about that.
Yeah, because it really is just a big dump. I mean, it's kind of a shame because there is a lot of setup they did environmentally that just doesn't pay off because your brain is just swimming while they're throwing
stuff.
Well,
and you
at
need
you.
Context as well. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. if you have more supporting content there around that, maybe you're going to make more connections about, oh, well, these are some things in the environment. So that, you know, but it, you know, I think like, for me in the second half of the game, particularly, I just kind of switched off a bit in that regard, and it right. kind of just went, you know, okay, just let's, you know, complete another one and keep going. And like I said, you know, more of a just a matter of process at that point. I wasn't as kind of invested in just waiting for the in a story way for the game to kind of start again, if you know what I mean. And that's something that, you know, Zelda games have had issues with, you know, certain ones where,
oh, yeah.
you know, it's like quite a lot of story happens at the start and then maybe along the way. And then like after you get the Master Sword, then the story takes a vacation until you're ready to
yeah,
go.
Yeah, it's like, all right, now it's time to go clear some dungeons to get the, Gamidoku, just whatever garbage.
yeah,
you
whatever
need to
it's
get.
Just yeah, before you're ready to face down Ganon, you know, and so the story just goes away for quite a while, you know, and that's something that, you know, that happens to quite a lot of games. You just get these sort of choke points for plot almost, you know, and this kind of falls into that trap, I feel.
So I did want to go around one time real quickly and just sort of get a real quick synopsis of like where you how you feel about them. I mean, John, you're not gonna have a whole lot to say, I understand, but like where you feel about this game and if how you feel about the fact that A, it took so long for us to get it, and B, kind of like, you know, just general feeling about the game and its place in the library of the system.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I was just I was actually impressed by it. I mean, I really kind of went into it with a blank slate. I really didn't know what to expect. But you know, it was something that definitely had a lot more depth than I thought. Had a lot more story to it than I thought, and a lot more, I guess, stuff to do. I mean, I thought it would be a pretty straightforward game, but it actually, you know, you could actually spend a lot of time doing stuff that was not just running through the towers battling.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the date sim stuff like that. So I was pretty impressed by it, but I could see how it could get repetitive by the end, because it does seem that they kind of show you, like, it's a little bit slow to start because they show you so much up front.
Right.
But that's the thing. I think if you're kind of interested, if you've enjoyed, you know, games like God of War and other stuff like that, I think, like, you know, if you have a Wii, I think it's definitely worth getting and checking out. Because there's really not much else like it on Wii. And like I said, I really don't know why Nintendo of America wouldn't want to fill the niche that this game fills by bringing it over. I mean, it didn't cost them anything in the end, and it did get brought over, but I still don't know what the big deal was. I feel like this game, it was kind of made to be something that it really wasn't, in a way.
Right.
The kind of, like, sort of hoopla around it really wasn't that big of a deal of a game anyways. If it just would have been brought over, people would have said, oh, okay, it's pretty cool. But instead it became this thing that everybody lusted after.
Yeah, it's that whole absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Well, yeah, maybe there were, for some people who were talking about it being like a weak link in the thread, not so much the people beforehand, like what he was on about before, but, you know, like maybe people who picked up all three of the games that were featured by Operation Rainfall, like, and then thought this was like the weakest, you know, I mean, the expectations may have been a bit kind of raised out of proportion by it being lumped in with these, you know, huge games that, you know, significantly more money would have gone into and, you know, probably take a lot longer to complete. And all, well, definitely in the case of Xenoblade, I haven't played the last story.
Yeah, I mean, to me, to give my thoughts on it and just touch on that, I mean, to me, it is obviously the weakest of the three. I mean, I say that, but I don't say that because I think it's a bad game or that it's even anything less than a good game. I think it's just the competition, of comparison for those two, its ambition is so much more down to earth that it would be very difficult to stand out. I mean, even the last story has serious issues standing out against the just smorgasbord of ambition that is Xenoblade.
Yeah, exactly.
it's sort of an all eclipsing, you know, situation. even the Zelda games on the console have some problem there, to a certain extent. So, yeah, it's an unfavorable comparison to find themselves in, but in that it's a very different style of game, I feel like that actually was to its benefit, and that it was able to kind of get over that.
I feel like a lot of emphasis has been put on the fact that you're feeding this vegan girl the heart of the monsters that you kill, and I'm not sure if that was doing the game a service or not. I mean, yes, like at heart, it is kind of a... just an action game, straightforward action game. Yep. And it's kind of exactly what I've craved for a long time on the Wii. And it's just too bad that we got it this late. And I feel like it's one of those games that the list, unfortunately, is shorter than it should be. But there are tons of games like that people mention when they think of great, full, meaty Wii games like Little King Story or Prince of Persia and things like that. And this, you know, this is one another entry on the list that deserves to be on that list.
I think it staked that its own little place too by putting these other things on top.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I kind of came in, as I said before, I hadn't been intending on getting it. I was very familiar with it, just, you know, from following the news and all that and doing the show at the time before it was coming out and stuff. But fact is, when I ultimately got it and played it, you know, I didn't have a lot of expectations invested in it. And I think that's the best way to enjoy it, is not to get too wrapped up in expectation about how it compares to the other Rainfall games or the weirdness of it and all that kind of stuff, or, you know, how much it's like a God of War or Zelda or what. Just, you know, try and take it for what it's worth and, you know, what it is, as much with a blank slate as much as possible. And I found that it was just an enjoyable mix. And yeah, you know, the fact that it was that kind of game, but, you know, kind of leveraging some of the Wii strength with the pointer and stuff was, you know, refreshing and nice to get that at least, you know, right before the end of the Wii's life cycle, you know. It was pretty much that or nothing. But, you know, I think what I'm most pleasantly surprised by in it is just the fact that, you know, it was a bit more on the cerebral side than perhaps I was expecting, in terms of, you know, some of the puzzle solving and the level design being quite carefully crafted for quicker retraversal to make, like, making runs back to Elena less irksome, you know, things like that. Yeah. Like there's a thoughtfulness to the design there that, you know, goes beyond what you might expect from something that's kind of aping, you know, these hack and slash games or character action games like God of War and stuff. So that was what probably you know, I enjoyed the most, was just the fact that, yeah, you know, the even though it is rough around the edges, you know, the production values aren't great and all that, there's still a certain level of thoughtfulness there that really helps. But obviously, at the same time, yeah, there's no denying that there's some serious padding going on with the second half of the game. Like, kind of,
that's
so
unfortunate.
It feels kind of, to me, it feels like the kernel, you know, the kernel of the game is really quite a unique and strong kind of mix, and that, you know, had it been taken forward with a bit more enthusiasm about what it could do commercially, or, you know, giving it a bigger budget, or the, you know, you could do a lot of things with it, but, you know, who will never know about that. Nintendo seemed content to kind of do it on a low scale. You know, I don't think they ever expected it to sell much in Japan, and I don't think they ever particularly expected to get out of Japan. You know, it may have even taken NCL by surprise that Europe went to the effort of localizing it. But all those things put aside, just on its own merits, I think it's a worthy addition to people's Wii libraries if you've any interest in these sorts of genres that we've talked about. And, you know, something of a sort of substitute for a 3D Castlevania on the system, mm-hmm. which we never got. And, you know, you could argue about whether Lords of Shadow is kind of so far away from Castlevania that it doesn't bear, you know, this bears more resemblance to the original series than that does.
So I think that does it for this particular retroactive. We'll probably do the next one in, I don't know, a couple months. So in the meantime, go ahead and put your requests or your suggestions in the suggestion thread, which is in the podcast section of Nintendo World Report forums. There's a pretty good list running at this point of games people have recommended. Just in case you're kind of new to this and trying to get the criteria, we're looking for games on, generally speaking, older systems. Wii kind of falls into that list now. We've done some DS games in the past. We haven't crossed the precipice of doing a 3DS game yet. And of course, haven't done a Wii U game yet, obviously. We want it to be on a Nintendo system. We want it to be readily available, so virtual console games are obviously in play. Games that can be found, you know, online or still in retail for relatively cheap are in play. So don't go put something ridiculous that there's no way somebody can get their hands on, because we're going to hate you for it. And we won't use it. So A, you'll be hated for no reason, and B, you'll not get what you want. So
we may still hate you. We reserve the right.
No, we will still hate you, but we also will ignore you, which is doubly bad.
But events is not good discussion anyway. So.
Exactly.
It'll be good discussion. Just we'll get Kohler on just to hear him cry about all the stadium events copies.
Yeah,
we all
go broke buying it, and then we're just like, yeah, it's like high jumping.
So go ahead and you know, give us your suggestions. You know, we're obviously if it's something that's unique that a lot of people probably missed on, it's ideal, especially if we haven't played it, because it gives us the opportunity to kind of expose ourselves to something new, and that's kind of the whole purpose of the segment. So again, next week we'll probably be running listener mail. Hopefully Johnny will be back. We'll see. But in the meantime, go ahead and send us your email. We are always looking for more. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You know, questions, comments about the show, whatever you want, send it that way. We haven't plugged this in a while, so reviews on iTunes, that is where people find the show. So if you are an iTunes member and you subscribe to the show, please rate and review the show. It helps us out on people finding the show and gets us new listeners, and we like new listeners. Of course, we have our forums where you can go to the TalkBack if you want to talk to us about the show, but it's not the email. And I think that's it for plugs this week. Are we good? I think that's all the plugs we do this week. So, yeah. Again, I want to thank Greg for being here this week, especially on the short notice.
No trouble at all.
Really good to have a fourth person here to talk about this game, especially somebody else who's beaten it. And, of course, John Gilm, thanks for being here, as always.
Always a pleasure.
No prob.
And thanks to whomever suggested this game. I'd actually found it a couple days ago and then lost it, so you know who you are. You probably don't, because it was months ago, but if you do know who you are, thank you. Be sure to tune in next week, and until then, bye.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Guillaume? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah,
have we hit everybody?
Yeah, I was short. I was a sixth.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway.
So, whoa. Call went nuts there for about half a second.
Anyway, I said what I had to say.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was trying to just do a quick check in my head, and I was make sure I hit everybody. So yeah, I was going to say, the only game that I could think of, that at least character action games on the Wii, just to sort of wrap it up, that even remotely comes across the same way for me, was actually... Oh, was it Dragon Blade on the Wii? Was that the game I was thinking of, where you actually, it had very similar controls, where you controlled like a chain and just complete chaos with the Wii remote? I think that was the game. Somebody's gonna tell me I'm wrong, and they're gonna
email. Nothing. I've got nothing for Dragon Blade.
Dragon Blade. What?
Yeah, there was a Wii game that was had like these really, really. It's like a character action game with like really detailed Wii remote controllers. I want to say it's Dragon Blade. But Dishmer, it wasn't a very good game. It's just the controls were really good. It was like the controls were great, but everything else was terrible.
Got nothing.
It's nice that somebody finally went through the effort of putting together a game with these controls that work well, even if like it took the entire lifespan of the system and then some, like. Literally, and then some for this point. So, you know, I'm happy it's there. I think I'm glad we did the retroactive on it. I think it's a little bit tricky game to talk about gameplay wise because, you know, it is, you know, the character action games, there's, imagine doing a retroactive on God of War. I mean, then you cut the dragon's head off, dude, it's nuts. Yeah, I mean, there's, so really, we ended up talking a lot more about you know, the setting, the world building.
But that's the thing. I think that's what makes this game unique is the fact
it is an
action game like God of War, but it has all of that. Like, you can't really talk about that stuff in God of War. It's just, you know, I mean, that game is like, it's, you know, it's just a big over-the-top action game, but this actually has a lot more.
It's the cover of a metal album.
Yeah, and it, I mean, it has. I mean, this game has a lot more, just a lot more to it than that.
It's a hideous pun, which I didn't actually intend to make when I first thought of it. But it has more heart. I mean, you know what I mean? There's just more of a kind of personal kind of, you know, just emotion and kind of thought into the game rather than, oh, hey, what's badass? You know, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, it's not. It's more than just a string of set pieces.
Right. Cutting the tits off a harpy is all well and good.
Yeah,
but
now, you know, I like the God of War games. I mean,
they're not really conducive to the format. So that's why we end up talking
long,
more about.
Long on style, not subject.
Let's wrap up the wrapping up, please.
No. I think that's what made this game interesting, which is why I think if you're kind of confused or waiting to talk more about the gameplay, that's kind of why we pivoted in that direction. Just to clarify, in case anybody's wondering.